So in a sense, what we've been looking at this weekend is this path between Chokmah and Tiferet. We're looking at the sense of the non-dual will coming into the dualistic experience, becoming incorporated within the center of a presence that is Tiferet. Previously, we've looked at the complementary path of Bina, where the non-dual love does exactly the same thing. So in this place, connected to the non-dual, we stand in the place of Tiferet, and we stand in the place, really, of gathering together, bringing back into presence all that has become lost. And that includes that which has become lost in us, lost in the people around us, lost in the culture. It's not just an internal practice, it's also an external practice. And, you know, for example, Faye and Ali and Penny and I were involved in something about a week ago that involved helping a dead friend of ours find her way, having died very suddenly and got very lost. So part of that work of helping the lost can sometimes just be very literal. And, you know, and so it isn't just, so it is an what we're talking about, what we're looking at is an important work. And in a way, you know, we've had the contrast this weekend, extraordinary contrast this weekend, of full-on war happening in Israel while we look at this whole territory of disturbance and healing. You know, there's something like, on both sides of the moment, there's something like 1,000 people have died over the last 2 days, and that's probably a conservative estimate. And in a way, it's almost the counterpoint to what happens if we don't do this work. Well, that happens. If we don't do the work of reconciliation, if we don't do the work of bringing together opposites, well, the opposites, the acts in contention, as Charles Williams would say, play out in the most horrific kind of way. And where, you know, ideologies, Holly was talking about, the obsession by ideologies enables quite ordinary, decent people to do terrible things. I was looking at some of the pictures of Israel over lunchtime, and they're showing cars with bodies next to them, where people have been pulled out of cars and killed. Now, the people who will have done that will be ordinary people. They won't be monsters. But they will be ordinary people who are so polarized, so separated off from the sense of other, that in that moment it is possible for them to do that. Out of rage and fear and all the rest of it. And at the same time, Israel sending jets into Gaza City, which is this awful place. Gaza is the most awful place. To talk about it being the largest open-air prison in the world, it's absolutely true. It's completely awful. And so this tiny little place has been bombed, really, and bombed by Israeli jets. 20 people of one family killed. So that's what happens when we don't do this. So this sense of aligning with the tree of life, aligning with the deep energies, is essential and is significant. Now, when we are sitting up against these terrible world events, Ukraine, Israel, global warming, you know, it's very easy to think, oh, this is just ridiculous, I'm just making myself feel better. But actually what the masters of the Kabbalah would say is that it is one work. The work of the inside and the outside is one work. So as we work with the sense of inclusion, when we work with the sense of the speaking of the name, of inviting the sanctuary into being, of healing the klipot, we affect the whole of the universe. Now that's an act of faith. We cannot know this exactly, but actually if we start to behave as though this is true, what you start to notice is a series of synchronous moments that, if we listen to them, lead us step by step along the way. The more we understand both that clarity of will arising from the supernal, arising from Chokhmah, the more we can embody that, the more we understand the shadow aspect of that path, which is the confused and tyrannical will, the more we come into relationship both with the sense of light and power and direction, and can influence the places of confusion and tyranny. When we sit here thinking or being aware of the unity underneath Israel-Palestine and Israelis and Palestinians, when we affirm the unit, when seeing the separation, feeling the pain and the disturbance, we affirm the unity. We affect that situation, not in any way we can name or understand, but it is my credo that this is true. It has been the experience of my life that one thing does lead to another, and that we live in an universe that communicates. And if we enter the conversation, we are communicated with. You know, it's just interesting for me if I think of the Israel situation, because I know the Israelis very well. I have many friends with Israelis. I have friends who are Arabs. I have spent a lot of my life listening to the in the country, being in the place where these things are fought out. I've listened to many conversations from different viewpoints over the years. And where it takes me to, so I mean, no doubt all kinds of politicking will happen around this, but where it takes me to is the place where I refuse to choose Israel or Palestine. It takes me to the place underneath that split. It takes me to the place where I love Israel. Much as they can drive me mad, I do love Israelis. I also love Palestinian Arabs. And because we do live in a world where green wheat can appear out of nowhere, where I can enter a pub in Canton in Cardiff and be met by a man who reads my mind, who prophesies my future, and then vanishes. Because we live in a world where Ali and I can be walking around Salisbury Cathedral having a kind of a strange kind of conversation with a priest who just vanishes. I believe in a world where the mysterious becomes manifest. I believe in a world also where there is a great deal of lostness, a great deal of exile, a great deal of confusion and entrapment. And part of my work has been to enter into these places carefully, with preparation, to enable the freeing of the lost. And it is a great blessing and a delight to do this work. A great gift to be able to do it. When last week our friend made his transition and she was very lost. She's both very lost. And there was a moment when our friends had an image of them jumping on a motorbike and roaring off. And I had an image of them being held in the arms of Isis and being, for a moment, happier than I think I've ever seen her. And so that is the reward of the work. That is the, however difficult, however painful, however disturbed, the disturbance is local. The infinite light, power and love of the divine is always greater than the disturbance. The disturbance feels larger, feels more powerful, because we are immersed in it, but there is a larger field that we are at the service of. And this is that place that Charles Williams talks about, the organic body that sings together. And it is the capacity of those who can do this work to participate in the harmonizing, the enabling of that organic body to sing in tune, rather than to enter into disharmony and discordance. The organic body sings together. And the capacity of the will and the imagination and the prayerful intent to bring healing, to bring resolution, is limitless. It brings us in to a sense of being able to reach all places and all times. So when we look at working with time and space, like we did this morning, and loosening that knot, it frees our awareness to meet any situation in any place, in any time, with kindness and blessing. And to enter then in this sense that they describe in the Kabbalah as the great bundle of the living. It's a lovely word, to be bundled together, to be connected together, to be there to be no one who gets left out. That is the intention. No one left out. And the sense then in which what we enter into is a great field of cooperation. Where we willingly and enjoyably bear each other's burdens. And similarly, our burdens are shared and borne by others. This is the great image of the completely interconnected universe, the multi-leveled conversation happening in all places and at all times. In Arche Protem Logos, in the beginning, there is the conversation. And great beings like the Buddha, like Christ, come to remind us of that. The Buddha points at the profound interconnectedness of everything. From the arising of this, that arises. This being, that comes to be. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. This being not, that becomes not. Where this and that is everything. So from the arising of any one thing, everything else arises. The ceasing of one thing, everything else ceases. There is a profound dialogical process of arising and ceasing, profoundly interconnected at all levels, from quantum physics to cellular to human relationship to between cosmoses. Christ says to us, love thy neighbor as thyself. Not instead of oneself, as thyself. He takes us straight into that dialogue, that loving your neighbor as you love yourself. He equalizes equivalences, takes us into that conversation. You know, Christ's teaching boils down to, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. Thy God, this is the God in Tiferet, Elohi, Yod Heh-Vav-Heh Elohim, Eloha, Elohi, the God that is in my heart. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. And our neighbor is everything, every being. So that sense of the vertical connection, the tetragrammaton Elohim, Yod Heh Vav Heh Aloha Vada'at, the God that I know, the God that sits in my heart. I relate to this with all my will, with all my strength, with all my heart, and my neighbor as myself. I'm going to end it here. I just want to read you a bit of a Charles Williams novel. It's called, unpromisingly, it's called Descent into Hell. And it's completely about this territory of this connectedness and working with disturbance and what happens. And also it's about the will. It's about one of the central characters, a character called Wentworth, chooses to descend into hell. He refuses the potential to enter into communion with others, with the world. And he chooses it to a very particular kind of fantasy and sort of, and it's quite a powerful book, really. And if you're interested in, you know, he's an older writer, so he's not always very accessible, but he describes in Descent into Hell the territory that we've been looking at in this weekend very powerfully. And the part of the book that we're at the moment is the chapter title is called The Doctrine of Substituted Love. And there's a figure in the book who's a playwright called Stanhope, who's a sort of, who's an accomplished kind of mystic, and he's talking to a young woman called Pauline, who's one of the principal characters in the book, who's trying to work out her own path with quite a lot of confusion and difficulty. So Stanhope, so she's having this conversation with Stanhope. And she's frightened because she keeps getting a doppelganger appear before her. And she says this, "I have a trick," she said steadily, "of meeting an exact likeness of myself in the street." And as if she hated herself for saying it, she turned sharply on him. "There," she exclaimed, now you know exactly, and what will you say?" Her eyes burned at him. He received their fury undisturbed, saying, "You mean exactly that?" And she nodded. "Well," he went on mildly, "it's not unknown. Goethe met himself once on the road to Weimar, I think, but he didn't make it a habit. How long has this been happening?" "All my life," she said, "at intervals, long intervals, I know, months and years sometimes, only it's quicker now. Oh, it's insane, no one could believe it, and yet it's there." "It's your absolute likeness," he asked. "It's me," she repeated. "It comes from a long way off, and it comes up towards me, and I'm terrified, terrified. One day it'll come on and meet me. It hasn't so far, it's turned away or disappeared. But it won't always. It'll come right up to me, and then I shall go mad or die." "Why?" he asked quickly, and she answered at once, "Because I'm afraid, dreadfully afraid." "But," he said, that I don't quite understand. You have friends. Haven't you asked one of them to carry your fear?" "Carry my fear?" she said, sitting rigid in a chair, so that her arms, which had now lain so lightly, pressed now into the basketwork, and her long, firm hands gripped it as if they strangled her own heart. "How can anyone else carry my fear? Can anyone else see it and have to meet it?" Still in that public place, leaning back easily as if they talked of casual things, he said, "You're mixing up two things. Think a moment and you'll see. The meeting it, well, that's one thing, and we can leave it till you're rid of the other. It's the fear we're talking about. Has no one ever relieved you of that? Haven't you ever asked them to?" She said, "You haven't understood, of course. I was a fool. Let's forget. Isn't Miss Parry efficient?" "Extremely," he asked, "and God redeem her. But nicely. Will you tell me," Mrs. Parry is one of the organisers of the play, very much a busybody, "and God redeem her, but nicely, will you tell me whether you have any notion of what I'm talking about, and if not, will you let me do it for you?" She attended reluctantly, as if to attend with an unhappy duty she owed him, as she had owed others to others, and tried to fulfil them. She said politely, "Do it for me." "It can be done, you know," he went on. "It's surprisingly simple. And if there's no one else you care to ask, why not use me? I'm here at your disposal, and we could so easily settle it that way. Then you needn't fear it, at least. And then again for the meeting, that might be a different business if you weren't distressed." "But how can I not be afraid?" she asked. "It's hellish nonsense to talk like that. I suppose it's rude, but it's no more nonsense than your own story," he said. "That isn't. Well, very well, this isn't. We all know what fear and trouble are. Very well, when you leave here, you'll think of yourself that I've taken this particular trouble over instead of you. You'd do as much for me if I needed it or for anyone, and I will give myself to it. I'll think of what comes to you and imagine it and know it and be afraid of it, and then you see you won't. She looked at him as if she was beginning to understand that at any rate he thought he was talking about a reality. And as she did so, something of her feeling for him returned. It was, after all, Peter Stanhope who was talking to her like this. Peter Stanhope was a great poet. Were great poets liars? No. But they might be mistaken. Yes, so might she. She said very doubtfully, "But I don't understand. It isn't your, you haven't seen it, how can you?" He indicated the rehearsal before them. "Come, if you like that, will you tell me that I must see in order to know? That's not pride, and if it were, it wouldn't matter. Listen, when you go from here, when you're alone, when you think you'll be afraid, let me put myself in your place and be afraid instead of you." He sat up and leaned towards her. "It's so easy," he went on, "easy for both of us. Needs only the act. For what can be simpler for you to think to yourself that since I am there to be troubled instead of you, therefore you needn't be troubled? And what can be easier than for me to carry a little while a burden that isn't mine?" She said, still perplexed at a strange language, "But how can I cease to be troubled? Will it leave off coming because I pretend it wants you? Is it your resemblance that hurries up the street?" "It is not," he said, "and you shall not pretend at all. The thing itself you may one day meet. Never mind that now, but you'll be free from all distress, because that you can pass on to me. Haven't you heard it said that we ought to bear one another's burdens?" "For that means," she said and stopped. "I know," Stanhope said, "it means listening sympathetically and thinking unselfishly and being anxious about and so on. Well, I don't say a word against all that. No doubt it helps. But I think when Christ or St. Paul or whoever said bear, or whatever he Aramaically said instead of bear, he meant something much more like carrying a parcel instead of someone else. To bear a burden is precisely to carry it instead of you. If you're still carrying yours, I'm not carrying it for you, however sympathetic I may be. And anyhow, there's no need to introduce Christ unless you wish. It's a fact of experience. If you give a weight to me, you can't be carrying it yourself. All I'm asking you is to notice that blazing truth. It doesn't sound very difficult. And if I could," she said, "if I could do whatever it is you mean, would I? Would I push my burden onto somebody else?" "Not if you insist on making an universe for yourself," he answered. "If you want to disobey and refuse the laws that are common to us all, if you want to live in pride and division and anger, you can. But if you will be the best of a part of the best of us and live and laugh and be ashamed with us, then you must be content to be helped. You must give your burden up to someone else, and you must carry someone else's burdens. I haven't made the universe, and it isn't my fault, but I am sure that this is a law of the universe, and not to give up your parcel is as much to rebel as not to carry another's. You'll find it quite easy if you let yourself do it." "What of my self-respect?" she said. He laughed at her with a tender mockery. "Oh, if we are of that kind," he exclaimed, "if you want to respect yourself, if to respect yourself you must go clean against the nature of things, if you must refuse the omnipotence in order to respect yourself, the why you should want so extremely to respect yourself is more than I could guess. Well, go on and respect. Must I apologize for suggesting anything else?" He mocked her and was silent. For a while she stared back, still irresolute. He held her, presently held her at command. A long silence had gone by before he spoke again. "When you're alone, remember that I am afraid instead of you, and that I have taken over every kind of worry. Think merely that, say to yourself, he is being worried, and go on. Remember it is mine. If you don't see it, well, if you do, you will not be afraid. And since you are not afraid," she stood up, "I can't imagine not being afraid," she said. "But you will not be," he answered, also rising, certainty in his voice, "because you will leave all that to me. Will you please me by remembering that absolutely?" "I am to remember," she said, and almost broke into a little trembling laugh, "that you are being worried and terrified instead of me. That I have taken it over, all over," he said, "so there is nothing left for you. And if I see it after all," she asked. "But not after all," he said. "The fact remains. But see how different a fact if it can't be dreaded, as of course it can't by you. Go now, if you choose, and keep it in your mind still. Shall I see you tomorrow? Or ring me up tonight, say about 9, and tell me you're being obedient to the whole fixed nature of things. I'll ring up, she said, but it sounds so silly. It is silly, sooth, and that dallies with the innocence of love. Real sooth, real innocence, real love. Go with God. They shook hands, and slowly, looking back once, just before she reached the lane, she went out of his sight. Stanhope, turning his eyes from her parting figure, looked at the rehearsal, settled himself more comfortably in his chair. A certain superficial attention, alert and effective in its degree, lay at the disposal of anyone who might need it. Exactly as his body was prepared to draw in its long outstretched legs if anyone wanted to pass. Meanwhile, he disposed the rest of his attention according to his promise. He recollected Pauline. He visualized her going along the road, any road. He visualized another Pauline coming to meet her. As he did, his mind contemplated not the first, but the second Pauline. He took trouble to apprehend the vision. He summoned through all his sensations an approaching fear. Deliberately opened himself to that fear. Laying aside for a while every thought of why he was doing it, forgetting every principle and law, absorbing only the strangeness and the terror of that separate spiritual identity. His more active mind reflected it in an imagination of himself going into his house and seeing himself. But he dismissed that, for he desired to subdue himself not to his own natural sensations, but to hers first, then to let hers, if it should so happen, to be drawn back into his own. But it was necessary first intensely to receive all her spirit's conflict. He sat on, imagining himself to the long walk with its sinister possibility, the ogreish world lying around, the air with its treachery to all sane appearance. His own eyes began to seek and strain and shrink. His own feet, quiet though they actually were, began to weaken with the necessity of advance upon the road down which the girl was passing. The body of his flesh received her alien terror. His mind carried the burden of her world. The burden was inevitably lighter for him than for her, for the rage of her personal resentment was lacking. He endured her sensitiveness, but not her sin. The substitution there, if there is indeed a substitution, is hidden in the central mystery of Christendom, which Christendom itself has never understood nor can. Since he could not take, nor would he have admitted, her hate and rejection, her passion was received into the lucidity of his own spirit. The experience itself, sharply as his body took it, was less sharp for him, not that he willed it so, but because his senses received their communication from within, not from without. And there is in all holy imagination from goodwill a quality of greatness which purifies and stabilizes experience. His goodwill went to its utmost, and utmost goodwill can go very far. It went to all but actual vision, and it excluded his intellectual judgment of that vision. Had he been asked at that moment for his judgment, he would have answered that he believed sincerely, that Pauline believed sincerely that she saw. But whether the sight was actual or not, he could not tell. He would have admitted that it might be but a fanatic obsession of her brain. That made no difference to his action. If a man seems to himself to endure the horrors of shipwreck, though he walks on dry land and breathes clear air, the business of his friend is more likely to be to accept those horrors as he feels them, carrying the burden, than to explain that the burden cannot, as a matter of fact, exist. Given all reasonable talk as well, wherever there is intelligence enough of exchange and substitution to exist, there is place enough for action. Only when the desire of an obsession has carried its subject beyond the interchanges of love can the power of substituted love itself cease. It would have been small use for any adept, however much greater than Peter Stanhope, to have offered his services to Wentworth. This is the man who is bent on descending into hell. Where he sat in his own room with a secret creature of substantial illusion at his feet, caressing his hand. For from that haunting, even while it was but an unmaterialized anguish within his blood, Wentworth had no desire more than the desire of maddened pride to be exquisitely free. So devoted to the action of his spirit, Stanhope sat on amongst the sounds of laughter and gaiety and half-serious wrangles that rose around him. It was not a long while that he was left to sit alone. Perhaps Pauline had not more than partly advanced on her return when someone came across to interrupt and consult him. He gave her full attention, for that other concern is not measured by time, but by will. To give freedom to both, he would return to his task when opportunity next offered, afterwards when they'd all gone away and he was alone. But that was rather more for the sake of his own integrity of spirit than that more was needed. The act of substitution was fully made, and if it had been necessarily delayed for years, but not by his fault, still its result would have preceded it. In the place of the omnipotence, there is neither before nor after. There is only the act of will. So that's a very detailed and very kind of focused description of the inner act of working with the clipotic form within another. We can apply it also to ourselves, but Charles Williams is describing there, and this is something that he himself would do, is if you like an universe where our will and our attention are constantly in relationship with others, and are focused on enabling the release, enabling the return, the release from fear, the release from pain, the release from hate, as long as that person is willing. The one thing no one can do, no Christ, no Buddha, is to heal the unwilling. You see it in the stories of Christ, where he has to, in every miraculous thing he asks, and they assent, or they ask him. So in a certain sense, this, when we look at this act of will, we look at this particular process we've been looking at this weekend, this paragraphs of Charles Williams I've just read you, is exactly that process. He describes it very clearly and profoundly. And it's founded on that sense of the organic body of the empire singing together. And this sense of the Sodha Ibur, the secret of the combination, the secret of separation and union. And above all, it's not about the thing about this. The problem with this work sometimes is it can become a should. I should do this now. Well, now I should do this. I should go out and bear out these burdens. What you see happening between Peter Stanhope and Pauline, and then is a simple conversation and something arising that is naturally and arrived at. Not as some, Peter Stanhope isn't about to save Pauline, he's not on a mission, he's, you know, a conversation happens and something happens and he thinks, oh, I could do that. It's very commonplace. And then what he does very beautifully is to describe the inner gesture of that. And what he also portrays in the conversation, in a way, is the incomprehensible, through Pauline's the response, how incomprehensible that is, this mystery of the interconnected universe where we bear each other's burdens.
I love the fact that what he does is beyond space and time.
Yeah, completely.
And therefore is completely integrated with everything that's happening in the real world.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, totally. Not a problem at all, exactly. So it isn't about having to go and then do lots of rituals, lots of prayers. It's actually an act of intention, an act of will that is beyond space and time, in which, and okay, somebody's now come to talk to him about his script, so he'll attend to that, and then he'll return to that when, you know, when he needs to, when he's got the space and time to, and it does not diminish the act in any way.
Can you do that for situations or people that don't want to be healed?
You can obviously hold people in mind. But ultimately, no. You can hold people in mind. You can provide the opportunity, and therefore provide the opportunity for that possibility. But no, you cannot receive the burden unless they will it to you. It's the great limitation behind the practice of psychotherapy. However skilled the therapist, however effective, however clever, if the will of the person is set against it, there is literally nothing. The will is sovereign. So that sense of, if I do not want to be healed, if I do not want your help, you find it in that discussion where, you know, she can hear she's quite resistant, thinks she's being ridiculous, but actually is willing to give it a go. So it isn't that they have to write, I want to be healed. It is, will they, is there enough of an opening for them to let you in? And if there is, well, then maybe something can happen. But the will is sovereign. So if somebody says no, you know, so the other figure we have in that book is this guy called Wentworth, who in the end, you know, goes into some hellish place, willingly choosing and refusing all other opportunities. And so here we have Stanhope, who is this great adept, who cannot even touch him, cannot interfere, cannot stop him doing that.
Mm. I was thinking about, of course, it's very personally painful when all you can do, like for someone who's perhaps an addict or something like that, all you can do is
hold
in the light.
Yeah, I know.
But in a way, it's a similar thing for situations like Gaza and Iran and other places where you so much want all the people that are sort of wanting things to be good and wanting to have a good relation, you so much want that to sort of thrive.
Yeah.
And I was thinking earlier about how I watched 7 Years of Tibet for like the 100th time recently, and there's a scene where and I know it's sort of romanticized, of course, but there's a scene where the Dalai Lama's a young boy and he's having this dream of the invasion and the sort of atrocities that are going on, and it's very vivid and real.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it was real, but even the Dalai Lama, even this sort of...
Yeah, I can't stop it. No.
You couldn't.
Yeah, no, that's of course, that's painful, isn't it? That's been that, and that is because of the centrality of the will. So people can make choices, can do terrible things, can kind of, and we cannot stop that. We can't, by as an act of force, now kind of somehow make it be different. You know, if we think of the awful, terrible stuff that's happened to young women in Iran lately, and you know, you want to stop them. You want to stop these bloody men doing what they're doing. And of course, when we do that, we generate all kinds of difficult consequences. You know, in a way that, so that difficult thing of letting the will be sovereign, while offering the possibility of redemption, transformation, you know, it requires that we need a lot of help with that. It's why we cannot do that on our own. So this sense of us also being held, our part of our burden then is also that. Our relationship with that, our relationship with Iran, with Iraq, Israel, Palestine. You know, that's part of the burden we as aware human beings carry. And so we carry that for each other. The angels and archangels and all the company of heaven also help us to carry that. It is too big for us individually. And that's part of the humbling nature of this practice, where you have to accept help. And part of me loves that and part of me hates that. It's a very complicated feeling.
It's a huge thing, isn't it? The problems most people have accepting help. Mm. Although they're so willing to give it, such nice people.
Mm.
But that sense of having to be separate and sovereign, meaning no one can help me, I've got to be in charge of my whole life the whole time and never receive help, is a real real thing I've noticed in so many capable people.
Yeah, it is. And partly
a gift, isn't it, to the other people accepting help.
Oh gosh, definitely. And partly it's a sort of not understanding that our wills are sovereign. In a certain sense, because in a sense, partly what happens then is my, instead of really knowing my will is sovereign, my sovereignty is buttressed by the idea that I don't need help. So I don't quite believe in the sovereignty of my own will. And in a way, what I like about that that Charles William excerpt is it's so ordinary. And he's just saying, well, it's very ordinary. Don't even make a fuss about it. You know, I'll just do it and you'll feel less afraid. You know, it's all right. You know, it's not a big thing. It's a very ordinary kind of thing. And he's saying, and he's almost incredulous. Well, why wouldn't you do it? You know, it's written so beautifully and so sanely in that way, I think, you know, that it challenges all these other places in us. Very interestingly. I need to finish. Is anybody with a burning question or thought before we bring it all to an end?
We just end with a moment of like connecting to something.
Yeah, I'm going to do that as an ending piece. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to do that. Just if anybody's left with some question or something they haven't understood or something they just want to ask, just before we finish. No.
I'm just impressed that will is sovereign. Makes such a lot of sense, but it's so shocking to me.
Well, I think it is shocking, Andy. I don't think it's any. Yeah, I think it is shocking. I think particularly, you know, for many of us, perhaps even most of us, as children, will have had our will overridden, so we don't know that our will is sovereign. And in a way, when you get that, it makes a lot of difference to all kinds of things. But it's not an easy, it is a slightly shocking thing if you really kind of let that in.
They're with ex-clients who were powerless in some way, but their will not change.
No, totally. I mean, you and I have had lots of examples of that and talked about lots of examples of that in the past, but, you know, sort of, you know, you're a very skilled therapist, and I think I am as well, but we are literally powerless in the face of the person who will not let us in, who will not do that minimum of allowing, you know. And all we see in the Charles Williams quote is saying, well, all right then, you know, it's not a big surrender, but it's that minimum necessary in order for something else to happen, and often people don't have that. They have a refusal in place of that somewhere. And in a way, that's why he uses this other character of Wentworth, who absolutely is the person who refuses and tells us quite straightforwardly, well, there's no point in offering anything to Wentworth. It won't work because of the sovereignty of the will.
Terror of
probability.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. Okay, everybody. Well, great. It's been a nice weekend with everybody, and I look forward to seeing you in about, I think it's about a month, isn't it? We're next meet, and back in the office in November, which will be nice. Ali and I
will have to end with any carnival malarkeys, do we?
No, I think I've managed it okay this time. I don't know, we're not at the same time as the carnival, thank God. So that's over the years I've sort of learned my lesson on that one. So the sequence avoids both the carnival and the Glastonbury Festival. You'll be glad to learn. So yes, that should be okay. So as we finish, let's just sit together for a moment and just gather ourselves. And just breathe. Just for a moment, let us just rest in the organic body that sings together. Rest in the place of bearing each other's burdens, and our burdens also being held in this great field of interconnectedness. Letting ourselves rest, letting ourselves be nourished by our interconnectedness and our enjoyment of each other. May we all be held in the blessing of the Holy Fo and the Shin. May the healing name Yud He Shin Vav He be ever in our heart. May we know that we are seen, that we are loved, that we are protected, that we are helped. Amen. Let's hope that Fern, I don't know if Fern is still with us, or she is. I hope she's quickly recovers. I hope Marcus, you recover more quickly as well, really. Oh, Fern's just appeared. Hi, Fern. Fern, I hope you really, really feel better soon, lovely. And I hope the damn thing moves through you very quickly.
Thank you.
And for you, and you too, Marcus.
You'll be vertical again.
Thank you.
So everybody, good. All the stuff will be up on the website by the end of tonight, and most of the talks are there already. The chapter, a lot of the technical stuff on the clipboard, it's all there. A lot of things I've talked about is all there in the book. So if you can't quite remember, you can go back to the book and look at it. And the book I was reading, if you're reading from, is an excellent book in this territory. If you're interested in a novel, that's not the easiest of reads, but it's brilliant. So it's Gateway to Hell by, not Gateway to Hell, that's Child of the Dennis Wheatley. That's quite a different writer. Descent into Hell by Charles Williams. So if you want to read that, you will find that instructive, really. And now we can be all released to discover who is getting kicked out of Strictly this week.
Oh yes, it is all right, Patricia.
I like Batman.
You want Batman to be checked out, or you like him?
No, I like him.
Oh, you like him? You like him? Okay. Who do you want to be checked out, Faye? Who do you think should go?
The one who was bottom last week, who was in the dance off last week. I think she's probably the worst.
She's strange, actually, isn't she? Because she looks like she should be good, but she somehow doesn't quite do it. It's quite odd. Anyway, those of you who aren't strictly fans of babies.
What about you?
What do I think?
Don't say Angela Ripper.
I know. You see, you have given me a dilemma around Angela Rippon, because you told me that Blossom loves her, and actually I have a complication about. I wouldn't mind her going, but actually I don't want Blossom to be upset. So that is quite That's quite complicated for me now. Actually, I tell you who I would like to go. He's actually not a bad dancer, but I don't like him. It's that bloke. Oh, the mouthy bloke who kind of black hair, quite short.
Batman, wasn't it? No, Adam.
Adam.
He was Mario and Luigi.
Mario and Luigi. That's the one. He was Mario and Luigi. Him. Yeah, I want him.
I don't mind him going.
I want him to go. I don't like him. off to Gehenna with him.
You must have a connection with Strictly, because. Did you set up that dance right at the beginning of it yesterday, where there was love, there was will, because they were doing their formation dancing, they were dancing together, and then at the end of it all, the light just flooded in.
Oh God, it did, didn't it? Well, I hadn't spotted that, to be honest, but yes, you're right, of course it did do all of that. No, it wasn't me, but it was nice. I'm glad you noticed it, because I didn't. Great. Lovely, guys. Oh, hello, Blossom. Blossom's just appeared. Hi there.
Hi, Blossom.
Hi, Blossom.
Blossom.
Okay, guys. So have a lovely time. And Holly and I will have been to Egypt for the next time we come back. Yeah, so that'll be kind of fun.
Time.
We will do. We will. Okay, guys. Take care.
Get some photos.
There will be lots of photos for sure, beyond a doubt.
Love you.
Thank you. Yeah. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.